greatest theologian or the most powerful sorcerer. Not an obvious candidate to elevate to the council. At the time, some of the other monks had whispered he was a mediocrity at best. But he was cheerful, dogged, and thorough. Traits that allowed him to pursue matters more deeply and effectively than a man of greater talent but lesser focus. A lot like Lou, in fact, or rather, what Lou might turn out to be, if he pushed himself to the limits of his ability. Dante thought Mac's promotion had been an excellent decision, adding a sturdy keel to the ship of Narashtivik's governing body. Mac smiled smugly.
You got here fast.
I've made an amazing discovery, Dante said. Did you know that if you move your legs, you can cross distances? I'm sure news of Blaze had nothing to do with your haste. Where is she, the woman who thinks she saw him? Nax's smirk shrunk.
Oh, she's here.
Ish. Ish? Which room, Nak?
Here.
He gestured vaguely. In the city. Dante's scowl was as dark as the hailstorm they'd endured in the mountains. She brought news, credible enough to loon me about, to call me home early. Leaving Ollie was your decision. And you let her run off as she pleases? I couldn't very well lock her up in a cell, could I? Merely letting her inside the citadel was a breach of protocol. Would you like me to send her a note at the inn she's staying at?
Please, Dante said levelly.
Mac adjusted his black robe.
I bet you'll hear from her within the day. You can thank me then.
Deal. And if she's gone, I'll put you in the stocks. A wheeled form of my own invention that can be carted around by a team of diuretic goats.
Nak frowned, then waved a stocky hand. You're awfully skeptical for the future leader of a religious order.
How can you trust a thing until you've interrogated it within an inch of its life? Including priests are no exception.
Nak rolled his eyes.
Dante exited and headed down the hallway to see Ollivander. As he grabbed the handle to the council regent's chambers, the door swung inward, revealing a surprised-looking Lou.
Ah, found you, the young monk said. Ollivander's right here.
In his room, Dante said. Good thing I have you around as a guide. How else would I find my way around this citadel I live in?
Lou reddened and examined the corner of the room.
At its far end, Ollivander rose with a grin.
Dante! Finally decided to heed your superior's summons, did you?
Dante entered the chamber. Ollivander was a soldier and a hunter, and his quarters were adorned with antlers, bows, boar spears, and tapestries depicting famous hunts of myth, including the harpooning of Dodecapus by Viadella. Before seating himself in one of the stuffed chairs, Dante turned on Lou with a stare that bordered on a glower. Lou gave a little wave, exited, and shut the door behind him.
"Do you spend a lot of time chatting with the monks?" Dante said.
Ollivander shrugged a broad shoulder. "Since you refused to see me, I thought I'd see Lou in Lou."
He looked surprised.
"Look, I've made one of your jokes.
And you've also made me regret my decision to come see you."
"But you're here. And there's nothing we can do about that now.
Did you find the source of the signs? Didn't you get the recap from Lou? Don't trust his powers of observation?"
"He's keener than you believe," Ollivander said, "but it never hurts to have a second perspective."
Dante summarized the trip, beginning at Sol and continuing through their trek into the wilds, their encounter with the Kappa, and the witness of the lights that took the shape of Bardon. Ollivander's face was lined from sunshine, battles, and 40-odd years of existence, and as Dante explained what they'd seen, those lines grew deep as the ravines of the Wodens.
"Kappas are real."
"I doubt it too," Dante said. "Then one mistook me for a walking breakfast."
"I knew they once existed."
Ollivander gestured at the walls. "We have some of their relics around here somewhere. I thought they'd been rooted out centuries ago." What does it mean that they weren't?
That we ought to stay out of the Wodans?
Stop stealing my ideas, Dante said.
How did Astmodel perform?
I found him an admirable guide when I was rallying forces in the east.
Hesitant to get started, but effective once we got on the trail, or, more accurately, once we got on the rickety piles of rock that may never before have been scuffed by human souls.
Ollivander leaned back in his chair and clasped his hands over his stomach.
Now that you've seen it for yourself, what would your recommended course of action be?
Is this a test of my leadership?
So is every decision we make, except perhaps those we make in the water closet.
You're getting cruder. I think we're spending too much time together.
Dante tipped back his head and considered the ceiling.
I think we ought to send a monk with a loon to Sol.
If there are further developments, I want to know about it right away. Additionally, I'd like some of the senior monks, or a council member if there's a volunteer, to study the scales I removed from the kappa. I don't like anything I don't know how to kill.
The regent watched him.
Studying puzzles sounds like something you'd typically do yourself.
I will too, Dante said quickly.
Like you said, it never hurts to have another set of eyes.
If I said it, it must be true.
Agreed on all counts. I'll put together an escort and send a monk to Sol.
Thank you for making the trip.
It may have felt pointless, but building our relationship with the mountain people could pay off handsomely should it turn out Modigan's plotting his vengeance against us.
Is that possible?
What has Sombra heard?
Nothing to twist your skin about,
Ollivander said.
But it's a mistake to assume the enemy's standing still.
I'm sure he's scheming and strategizing no less than we are. Strengthening our alliance in the east can only help to dissuade him from poor ideas.
He reached for parchment and a quill.
I believe we're done. You'll be around if I need you?
Sure,
Dante said.
After a week of banging around the mountains, my feet would mutiny if I tried to march them another mile.
The lie was so egregious, he didn't even feel bad for telling it. He killed time in his room, examining the kappa's scales. He didn't do anything that might impact or damage them, merely touched them with the nether, which slid off as cleanly as water from the scales of a fish. Though each try yielded the same results, he repeated it tirelessly, trying to watch a different part of the reaction each time and thus understand why it was happening. Partly, he employed this method to pass the hours while waiting for word from Knack, but it was his preferred approach to all investigations. When confronted with a thing he didn't understand, he liked to quietly watch until that thing began to make sense. Only then did he dive in with active prodding, poking, and attempts to change, test, or break the object or concept in question. He wasn't always able to go about things in this manner, particularly out in the field, when time was scarce and lives were on the line, but for once, time wasn't at a premium. So he sat on his balcony, overlooking the city, the afternoon light glinting from the bay, washing the north shore, the smoke of the chimneys and forges mingling with the damp sea air. Despite his complaints, he enjoyed traveling, seeing new corners of the world, accomplishing things at the front of the action. But he also enjoyed being alone, like this, ensconced in his room with an object of interest. When the knock came at the door, he was actually annoyed. He cracked the door. Knack stood on the other side, looking smug again.
I told you I hadn't lost her.
Dante threw the door open.
Which room?
You're in for a crash course in the ways of our sharp-eyed lady. She's not in the Citadel. She wants to meet at midnight at the King's Folly.
The King's Folly? That's more than a little inconvenient. Think she plans to assassinate me?
Knack rolled his eyes.
I imagine Narashtovik's top nethomancer might be able to handle a run-of-the-mill assassin,
Dante gazed down the hallway. What if she does mean to kill me? Coming here with news of Blaze is a surefire way to get me to leave the Citadel. Which you never, ever do otherwise. Point taken. Thanks, Knack. If I don't come back, take my revenge. Along with all your property. At 10:30 that night, Dante descended the stairwell, lantern in hand, and exited into the courtyard. A chilly, seaborne breeze flowed over the walls. The guards at the gate opened the reinforced side door, and he walked north. The plaza between the Citadel and the Cathedral was well lit, but the streets beyond were often as dark as the skies. He didn't truly believe this mysterious woman was here to kill him, yet he couldn't shake a paranoid mood, and found himself glancing over his shoulder at every intersection. The streets within the inn gate were placid, respectable. Past that, the night grew more boisterous. People leaned outside taverns, talking with great enthusiasm. Sometimes to people who weren't there. Dante wore an unmarked jacket over a plain doublet. He drew no more eyes than anyone else. It was a long walk to the docks. The pier smelt of salt and the kelp that belched forth on the shores in voluminous quantities. Masts spiked from the docks. Lanterns shimmered on the waves. Longshoremen called back and forth, loading ships, drinking, or both. Dante turned west along the shore, putting the noise and lights behind him. He pulled up his collar to shield his nose against the smell of the fish guts cast back into the water by the tons every day. The piers stopped, and so did the city. Jumbled black rocks bordered a thin white stripe of beach. The King's Folly rested 100 yards from shore, a dark mass on the waves. Dante stumbled and fell into the sand. He tripped on an oar belonging to a rowboat beached above the hissing surf. He glanced at the King's Folly. 3 times a light winked from it, then vanished. Dante pushed the boat into the water, glad the tide was at its ebb, and rowed. The Gascon invasion had been primarily land-based, but Modigan had dispatched a small fleet as well, as much to distract the defenders as to actively battle them. Narashtovic's navy had been non-existent, however, and on discovering the waterways were clear, a clever Gascon general had embarked a portion of his troops on the king's ships, meaning to sail into the bay, circumvent the city's main defences, and break through the inn gate before Narashtovic could reposition its forces. But while Narashtovic had no official navy, it did possess a thriving class of folk who might or might not be labelled pirates, depending on how conservative you preferred your maritime law. While Dante and the others had battled to hang on to the city's walls, these merchant bandits had taken it upon themselves to meet the king's armada on the seas. Modigan's fleet hadn't expected any resistance, and the battle ended after the briefest exchange of hostilities. In attempting to turn about, the king's flagship became mired in a maze of sandbars. The crew and soldiers were taken prisoner. Narashtovic's pirate defenders attempted to claim the ship, but it was stuck fast, and during the argument about how to float it again, part of it burned down. The remainder had been out here ever since. When Dante closed within 50 feet, a silhouette appeared on the railing and aimed a bow at him. "Who's there?" Dante pulled the nether close. "Who do you think? Tens of thousands of people live in this city," the woman said, "and most of them are capable of manning a rowboat." "Dante Galland, high priest in training, blah, blah, blah." The woman lowered her bow. "Welcome aboard." Another rowboat was tied at a makeshift dock that had been hammered into the hull. Dante paddled to the dock, tied up, and leapt onto the ignominious carrack, which swayed and creaked gently in the perpetual currents. Boots clomped down the deck. A rope ladder whacked the side of the hull. Dante climbed it to the deck and was met by a young woman. It was too dark to make out much else.
"You've got my name," he said, rubbing his palm, abraded by the climb. "Why don't you give me yours and we can get to business?"
"See," she said.
"And I'm here to work for you."
"You said you found Blaze. How do you know it's him?"
"On the lead up to the war, I saw you two in Dolandon. In times of chaos, business is always good for people in my line of work."
"Which is?"
"Finding things. How do you think I got my name?"
There was an edge to a voice that might have been teasing.
"I spent a lot of time in public houses, because that's where the business is, and because I like to drink. I watched you play that Norrin game, saw Blaze too. A few weeks ago, I saw him again."
A hard wave struck the boat, yawing it. Dante gritted his teeth and regained his balance.
"Where?"
"In Galador."
"If you're dumb enough to think I'd tell you that, I'm getting out of Narashtavik before you accidentally burn it to the ground."
C brushed dark hair from her face. "I'm getting tired of moving from place to place and job to job. There's no future in it. You want Blaze. I want two things in return. First, a big fat sack of silver, up front, and second, a permanent position in the sealed citadel."
Dante snorted. "Doing what? Arranging my meetings in the most inconvenient places possible?"
"Finding whatever you need found. Watching whatever you need watched. You've earned more than your share of enemies, haven't you?"
"And I might be about to earn another. I'm not sure I have the power to offer you such a position."
"You're the high priest in training, blah blah blah, aren't you?"
"That doesn't give me infinite leeway to make decisions."
She smiled, teeth flashing in the starlight. "You don't want the others to know, do you? Do you want to keep your obsession secret, or do you want to find Blaze?"
He found the nether returning to his hands on its own. It would be so easy to hurt her, just a little, enough to scare her into talking. He might not feel good about it, but it would be much faster and painless, for him, than in promising her a permanent station in the citadel. But thinking like that was what had caused Blaze to renounce him. He closed his eyes and nodded.
"You'll get every penny of the bounty I've promised, up front, and the possibility of long-term employment."
"I don't want words. I want a writ."
"You'll get it as soon as I see Blaze,"
Dante said between his teeth.
"If you found him, where so many others have failed, I'm sure the Citadel would be happy to retain your talents."
She gazed at him, hair teased by gusts of salty wind and sporadic ocean spray.
"I trust you'll want to leave tonight."
"Are you ready?"
"I plan my day expecting to leave the place I woke up in."
"That would explain why you're not married," he muttered. "Do you have a horse?" C gave him a look.
"I wouldn't be much of a nomad without one."
"Well, I left mine in my castle. Meet me outside the Cathedral of Ivars in 2 hours. If this is a joke or a scam, you're a dead woman."
"Oh, I know," she said. "I saw you in the war, remember?"
He didn't offer to share the ride back to shore. Her rowboat kept easy pace with his. He pushed it without making it obvious he was pushing.
Yet they still hit the sands within seconds of each other.
He hurried back to the sealed citadel, tasked a servant to ready a horse, and jogged up to his room to gather his things. By the time he got back downstairs, his horse was there, breath wreathing its nostrils.
"Where are you going?"
Dante turned, expecting to see the stable hand, and gazed on Lou instead. Dante froze.
"What are you doing here?"
"Walking," Lou said.
"Around?"
"In the courtyard? In the middle of the night?
You don't expect me to take my walks in the city, do you?
They let anyone in that place."
"You're spying on me, aren't you?" Dante said. "For Ollivander."
"I think Aron would look down on one of his monks spying on his high priest."
"He frowns on lying, too." "I want the truth, or I'll demote you to Chief Manure Bin."
"I'm not spying," the monk said. "Just lounging about."
Dante stepped closer. "With the express purpose of keeping an eye on me."
"Was Ollivander concerned I'd get into trouble in the Wodens?"
"Get into trouble? No. Cause trouble? Yes. Which I didn't. I was an upstanding representative of this institution. Yet here you are, malingering like a case of malish pox."
"I'm not telling him anything bad. He just wants to make sure he's training you right. That's a big responsibility for him, you know."
"And running off in the middle of the night runs directly counter to it."
Dante sighed. "Well, there's only one thing I can do, then.
Get a horse. You're coming with me."
"Like hell I am. I'm leaving. Unless you want to fail in your mission to keep tabs on me, so are you."
Lou drew back his head.
"You're going to find Blaze, aren't you?"
"This time."
Dante glanced toward the Citadel gates.
"There's nothing in the world that can stop me."
Chapter 6 Birds burst from the canopy, fluttering and squawking. Arrows whacked into the sides of the wagons with metallic snaps like a hammer ringing on a nail.
Human arrows, Blaze registered dully. Not that he expected to be attacked by Norrin in the heart of Old Gask.
But he had become something of an expert on wagon train ambushes, both on offense and defense, and had learned that Norrin arrows, primarily obsidian, glass, or bone, didn't have the same clapping retort as iron arrowheads. The iron ones sounded nasty. If you imagined that noise as applied to your ribs or your head, it could paralyze you with fear. Until the bandits honed in on your indecisive self and put one of their arrows through your spine, paralyzing you for real.
"Bandits!"
He jumped from the seat of the wagon and hit the ground running.
"We're under attack!"
Which was obvious to everyone, with ears to hear the arrows sizzling through the leaves and slamming into the wagons. But guiding people through the straits of oh shit was much easier when you primed the pump first.
"Archers, return fire!"
Crouched low, he dashed into the trees beside the path. At some point he'd drawn his swords.
"Others, to me! Left sweep! Move!"
Men called out, thrashing through the brush behind him, his people, and ahead, the enemy. Someone was already screaming. Probably one of their own. Strangers moved in the trees, wearing green and brown clothing that matched the woods. Without breaking speed, Blaze began zigzagging, meaning to throw off anyone drawing a bead on him and to allow his people to catch up. The problem with an ambush like this was that it was so damn effective. For one thing, the enemy had the advantage of surprise. For another, they had total mobility within a covered environment. On the other side, the wagon train was confined to a one-dimensional track. Turning around was A, impossible, and B, fruitless. You could plow ahead, but this was a wagon team, not a legion of war horses. The enemy could keep up on foot. In the chaos, your wagons could get separated, or the bad guys could get frustrated and shoot your horses, leaving you screwed even if you won the day. Against a concealed opponent who could move around however they pleased, hiding behind the wagons and exchanging fire was a fool's game. Instead, you had to organize a counter-strike on the fly and execute it before their snipers sliced your squad to ribbons. Blazer's first mark was just noticing the less-than-subtle charge, pivoting beside a tree trunk and knocking a fresh arrow. Blaze waited for the archer's elbow to hook back, then flung himself to the left, rolling in the damp leaves. The arrow rushed by, wrapping into a tree trunk. Blaze popped up on his feet and ran toward him, but the man was already knocking another round. Blaze slung his left-hand sword at the archer, the weapon spinning end over end. The man grunted and jerked up his bow, deflecting the incoming blade with a clang.
Blaze rushed in behind it and jabbed at the man's chest. The archer turned aside, using the bow to guide the thrust past him. Blaze cocked his left elbow and slammed his empty fist into the man's chin. The archer's head snapped into the trunk with a dull thud. Blaze stabbed again, hooking in from the side, burying 4 inches of steel in the soft spot between the man's hips and ribs. The man gasped and feebly poked the bow's tip at Blaze's face. Blaze pushed the blade deeper, dropping him, then finished him off. He rolled between the trunk for a quick look at the field. Taya and the wagon's guards had raced past him, engaging targets of their own. Men shouted orders back and forth. Arrows hummed through the trees, but the shots were sporadic and hurried. The few of the enemy who weren't directly engaged were being peppered with fire by Blaze's archers at the wagons. Blaze grabbed his fallen sword and sprinted to assist the nearest guard, who was in a vicious one-on-one 20 feet away. Steel rattled on steel. The wagon guard fainted, and the bandit flicked his short sword at the man's hand. The guard cried out and reeled back, knuckles bloodied. The bandit smiled grimly and hurled himself forward, lunging directly into Blaze's sword. The guard put an end to him. Further ahead, Taya's thin swords were doing messy things to 2 men in green cloaks. They screamed for a second, then they didn't. The woods were dense, and the ambushers had to position themselves close to the road, allowing the wagon's guards to close on them in moments. Unseen bandits were calling out names from the other side of the path. The men on the wagons replied with arrows. Blaze ran forward, scanning the forest. He tried to join another engagement, but the guard cut his foe's throat before Blaze got within reach. The coppery scent of blood mingled with the rotting leaves. The voices from the other side of the road faded, retreating. Blaze's guards called to each other, checking off names. The battle was over. Taya jogged up to him, sweat sheening her forehead.
"We should chase them down. Did they piss you off that bad?"
Blaze got out a rag and began to wipe his swords.
"Bandits are just one of the hazards of the open road. Like a storm that rains iron-tipped arrows. You think these were common bandits?"
"I didn't see any crowns or purple robes." She glanced at their guards, who were tending to the wounded.
"We deliberately let all of Setevan know we had access to a fortune in Bossen. That would have motivated any number of candidates to arrange to take it away from us."
Blaze rubbed his mouth. "Whoever they are, they have a head start and know these woods better than we do. Did we leave any survivors?"
Taya swiveled on her heel and went from bandit to bandit. Most were dead or unconscious. 2 could speak, but one of them seemed incapable of words besides mother and water. The other one gave Taya a wicked smile and coughed blood at her face.
"We weren't hired by no one."
She drew back but made no motion to wipe her face.
"You sure about that? You have been stabbed in the vitals. It will take you hours to die."
"And whose blade put me here?"
He laughed coldly.
"I'd no sooner turn over a name than I'd hand you my children."
"You can always get hurt worse."
"Than a gut wound? Have at it."
Taya turned to Blaze and raised her eyebrows.
"Do I have permission?"
Blaze blinked and moved beside her, dropping his voice. "To mutilate this fellow?"
"This fellow was attempting to kill us."
"Typically, I try to hold myself to higher standards than murderers."
"He's dead either way," she said. "The question is whether you want to use his death to learn how to stop the next attempt."
Blaze inhaled deeply. "I left Narashtovic to escape that kind of thinking. Put the bastard out of his misery, and let's see what's left on the bodies." She gazed at him, judgment clear in her eyes, then knelt and cut the bandit's throat. Blaze didn't turn away, even as the man gurgled and clutched his neck. He had seen enough to know that looking away from a thing couldn't save you from its memory. Instead, looking was the only way to understand what you were doing. They went from bandit to bandit, rifling pockets, examining their clothing and weapons. Banditry was dangerous work. As a general rule, the only people willing to risk their lives to prey on the roads were homeless vagabonds. The rare few who actually struck it rich tended to retire or attempt to use their gains to establish a business that didn't involve crossing pointy objects with angry travelers fearful for their lives. In short, your average highwayman was dirty and dirt poor, often unable to field weapons more expensive than cudgels and spears. These men were a cut above that. All had bows and at least one iron blade. Their clothes weren't straight from the Setevan salons, but their cloaks were warm and showed little sign of mending. None were shoeless. Neither, however, did any of them wear any fancy jewelry besides the odd earring or necklace, or carry ruby-handled swords of watered steel. It was enough, so Blaze could believe, they'd been hired, but it left plenty of room for doubt. The dead carried little in the way of personal objects. A crude wooden frog. A knife with a handle made of antler that had been carved with images of ships at sea. A badly spelled letter from a wife urging the recipient to come home. A couple of wooden combs, one broken. The sundries of survival. Nothing to tie them to a palace aristocrat. Blaze rinsed his hands of blood and dirt and returned to the wagons. They'd lost two men. Five others bore wounds ranging from sliced knuckles to an arrow through the ribs that had probably punctured the man's lung. The crew's barber removed the arrow and bandaged him best he could, but there was little else they could do besides install the man in one of the wagons, resume the trip, and get him to a proper bed as soon as they could. For just a moment, Blaze missed traveling with Dante. Cold and violent as he often was, he was a born healer. If the dirty shadow slinger had been here, the man gasping in the wagon would already be back on his feet. Taya sat beside Blaze on the front wagon, watching the trees. This won't be easy to track down. What, you don't think I should drunkenly accuse everyone at the next ball? Blaze said. That's what a real nobleman would do. You're right. You should speak out. Getting assaulted on the highway and surviving is something you should brag about for cachet. But don't make accusations. But that's where I'm an artisan. He was quiet for a moment, the wagon rumbling beneath him. The sun was falling, and the air was growing cold. If this attack was paid for, seems to me there are two suspects with the most to gain. The Duke, Taya said. He might not be able to afford the bossen, but he can pay to have it stolen. Who's the second? Lady Caraday. When she thinks you've got a deal in place? Why? Because she's sly enough to know that makes her least suspicious, Blaze said. Also, her family was here before Gask, and I'll bet they'll still be here after the Empire crumbles. They're survivors. They know how to scramble. Taya considered this, then nodded once. A fair argument. Then there's the third candidate. Everyone else in Gask who likes money. Shadowy sedition can be so inconvenient, she grumbled. I'll turn over all the stones I can, but I doubt we'll get far. Then how do you suggest we proceed? Boast about the attack. Offer a reward for any information relating to the bandits. You wish to pursue those who got away. With any luck, someone on the inside will have a score to settle with the perpetrator and seize the opportunity to bring them down. They dispose of an enemy while scoring points with you. I'll make one last offer to Duke Dillinger, too, he said, but I can't let Caraday dangle for too long. He wasn't terribly happy with these resolutions. They were passive, unlikely to yield results. Perhaps he ought to petition the king. Concern for the safety of the roads, the prosperity of Gask, and so on and so forth. But that, too, was unlikely to gain him anything besides a small amount of political credit. Well, like they said, the longest journey begins with a single step. Maybe he could, in time, parlay this incident into real pull with the king. That would be something. Mentally,
he started composing his missive. The man with the lung wound died that night. They buried him by the road. Blaze lingered beside the freshly dug mound for a few minutes longer than the others. He meant to honor the man, he supposed, but they'd hardly known each other. He sighed and jogged to catch up. The remainder of the trip was as quiet as the portion before the ambush. They led the caravan off the main road, through low green hills, stashing it at an isolated farm some 6 miles from Setevan. "I expect we'll need you here another couple weeks," Blaze told the troops. "The larder is well stocked, and you'll be pleased to hear that I've installed a beer basement." "Right, and I expect to be selling the shipment soon. Consider your salaries doubled." Considerable cheers erupted from the guards and teamsters. Some went to investigate the basement while others tended to the horses and secured the barns where the wagons had been housed. Taya waited for her people to disperse, then moved beside Blaze. "Beer basement," she said. "Doubled salaries?" "I thought we'd better get on their good side before the sale," Blaze said, "since their chief duty after that will be hauling our purses around." "This isn't our money. It's earmarked for the glorious cause of driving our boot into the Empire's testicles." "Whatever the cause, these guys are risking their lives for it. They deserve a bonus." "And if some die, their families are supposed to be consoled by the jingle of silver?" "It's better than nothing," Blaze frowned, "especially if they have kids." Given that he intended to make a hullabaloo about being assaulted on the road, he thought it appropriate that Lord Pendulous would return to Setevan in the company of bodyguards. He enlisted two of the men to come with him on the carriage ride into the city. Bunches of letters awaited him at the house, primarily missives from merchants and minor lords looking for a piece of the action. These didn't particularly interest him, except as proof the Bossen market was still primed to explode. But he set about answering them anyway, including a lengthy, impassioned recap of the bandit attack, downplaying his role in the battle significantly. In this version, he killed but a single outlaw, and certainly hadn't led the charge into the woods that likely saved everyone's lives. He dispatched the responses via courier earlier that evening. There was nothing from Duke Dillinger. Lady Caraday had written, but it was a brief note, letting him know she looked forward to concluding their deal at his convenience. He considered delaying his response a few days to work on the Duke, but he'd already sent letters to a legion of Setevan's lesser stars. If he'd been dealing with normal people, they'd think nothing of the fact that, following a long trip from the city, he might take a couple days to respond to them. But Caraday was a person of importance. Pendulous, while carrying a certain influence of his own, was well short of her stature. If he dawdled with her, especially after having already replied to numerous people who couldn't match Caraday's power and influence if you threw them all together, well, a gaffe like that could lay waste to the entire relationship. In short, it was one of those things you just don't do. He penned a note thanking her for her letter and informing her that he expected to be able to move forward shortly. That timeline was vague enough that he wouldn't have to finalize the deal with her until he'd had the chance to do some public grousing about the safety of the roads and to take one last run at the Duke. This turned out blessedly simple. During Blaze's travels for the goods, Dillinger had relocated from his chateau to the palace in Setevan. Blaze sent the Duke a request in the morning. By afternoon, Dillinger replied with an invitation to the palace for the next day. Blaze considered informing the Duke he couldn't make it on such short notice, the implication being he was close to a major deal and the Duke had better act fast. But he couldn't let Caraday dangle that long. He accepted the invitation. He had been to the palace more than once, and as he dressed for the event, he felt no particular nerves. If anything, he was excited. It was always a pleasure to stroll the halls of the heart of Gask's power, knowing that he would soon burn them down. He hopped in his carriage and took off. As a foreigner in Setevan, he had been educated by multiple nobles looking to bring him up to speed and impress him with their knowledge of local history, so he knew the current palace wasn't the first, and that it hadn't always been this grand. But as the carriage swung down the boulevard, you could sure believe it had been around since the dawn of time, built not by common laborers, but by the gods. Tall, elegant homes lined the thoroughfare. After a quarter mile, this fed to a white stone gate. This was clearly a ceremonial feature, as beyond it lay a broad blue lake. The road continued across it on a causeway to the palace, which was abutted on its backside by stark white cliffs. Protected by the lake on one side and the cliffs on the other, it was all but impregnable. But Blaze thought it had been placed in this engineered landscape as much for its grandeur as for the defensive advantages. The bisected waters shimmered silver blue. At the far end, they reflected the palace, which resembled a layer cake, as seen by an approaching beetle, terraced, white, enormous, and simultaneously intimidating and intoxicating. Its round layers sported arched doorways and windows, and the terraces made for excellent viewing for visiting lords and ladies, who frequently took the sunshine on the upper floors. The central tier stood 12 stories high. While it was a general rule of cities that in any tall building, the poor were forced to live at the top and deal with all the stairs, the palace was an exception. For one thing, a cunning, donkey-powered platform had been rigged up to lift visitors and residents from one floor to the next. The king had a private platform for himself. And for the second thing, those on the upper floors simply summoned everyone else up to see them. As a result, the king lived in the narrowest, highest tier, with the following floors populated in rough correlation to the power, wealth, and status of their residents. Duke Dillinger was a handful of links removed from the throne, and was occasionally very rich. That put him on the terrace just below the king's. Blaze's carriage wobbled across the strip of land connecting the palace to the city. It reached the rolling lawn that surrounded the palace, and came to a stop in the red gravel outside the front steps. He left his driver and bodyguards, taking one footman to maintain appearances. At the top of the marble steps, they were greeted by two guards with crimson doublets and tall steel lances. One recognized Blaze, nodded deeply, and allowed him through. Inside, his steps were muted by the lush rugs that provided pathways across the airy marble entries. He and his footman crossed to the center of the palace, a wide, hollow pillar, and stepped onto a circular wooden platform. Blaze informed a waiting servant of the desired floor. The servant tugged a thin rope. Somewhere below them, a bell jangled, donkeys brayed, the platform shuddered, then began to climb. It rotated slowly up a thick central pole cut like a screw, carrying them past intervals of blank walls and landings. A couple minutes later, it rocked to a stop. A female servant unhooked a red rope barring the doorway, then ushered them into an airy circular room with doors spoking its outer walls. Blaze informed the woman of their destination, and she took them to one of the doors and announced them to the Duke. They were led inside a cool room, floored with bamboo that must have been imported from the slopes of Galador. One of the Duke's servants spirited Blaze's servant away and directed Blaze outside to a flat marble deck that served as the roof of the lower floor and the terrace of this one. The Duke sat beside an iron railing overlooking the lake.
"Greetings, Ansatz. You've been on a trip, so I expect you'll want to tell me about it."
Blaze smiled and moved to the railing.
"You sound thrilled to hear it. Should we cut to the chase and let you hang yourself from boredom? Why would I do that when I can order you hanged instead? Then I shall endeavor to entertain. How's this? We were attacked by bandits on the king's own road."
Dillinger turned from the lake to eye him up and down.
"You look like you came through all right." "Came damn close to fertilizing Willen Forest," Blaze said. "Most of the blackguards escaped us. I've already placed a bounty on them. Mighty keen to learn who hired them."
The Duke raised an eyebrow.
"You think someone set them upon you?
They're thieves. You are carrying thievables. I've never been much for math, but it's a straightforward equation.
There's always room for coincidence in the House of Greed.
Blaze tapped the railing,
which was hot with absorbed sunlight.
You're probably right, though. Why stretch to make it a conspiracy when everyday bandits would have attacked anyone with a wagon?
He furrowed his brow.
However, if it was a targeted attack, I doubt I'll be allowed to survive a second effort. Therefore, I'll continue my hunt for the odious toad behind the first, hypothetical though he might be.
All his life he'd been careless with words, slinging them around the way old men slung breadcrumbs to the ducks at the edge of the lake. The hardest part of adopting the pendulous persona had been learning to mind his tongue. Judging by the Duke's reaction, frozen expression, one hand slipping from the rails, Blaze had slipped character. Spoken words that must not be uttered. Had he pushed too far? If so, how would Dillinger react?
Blaze supposed that depended on two things. The Duke's perception of Pendulous, and the Duke himself. It would help that Pendulous was on the naive side, keen enough on business matters, but when it came to true intrigue, the kind worth killing over, Blaze had presented his alter ego as hopelessly ignorant. He believed the Duke would consider him completely incapable of exposing whoever was behind the attack.
But there was a chance Dillinger was spooked enough to make a mistake.
I assume, Dillinger said, you came here to talk about more than your plans for revenge.
Oh, yes, Blaze said, happy to move ahead. I'm back, and so are the goods. Thought I'd drop in and see if your circumstances had changed.
Unfortunately, no, but I appreciate the offer.
Blaze bowed his head.
Anything for the man who introduced me to run.
Dillinger turned toward the lake and laughed. Normally, protocol would insist they spend some formalized time together, sharing drinks, a meal, or gossip. But the Duke was less concerned with protocol than most, and knew Blaze would prefer to get on with business elsewhere.
Blaze collected his footmen and returned to the lift, which was ascending from below. It stopped on their floor a minute later. An older man, whose eyes couldn't decide if they were brown or green, exited. He saw Blaze, and his face lit up.
Lord Pendulous, what brings you to the palace?
Blaze smiled at the man, a Galladese trader who'd become a minor lord in Setevan 2 decades ago, but who'd bitterly supported his former homeland during the war.
First a team of horses, then my feet, Blaze said. Today it's business. Tomorrow I hope it's to lodge a complaint with the king regarding the infestation on his roads.
The merchant lifted his eyebrows.
Infestation? Are the giant ants back?
Bandits?
Thieves?
Blaze leaned in theatrically. And if they aren't exterminated, the Tree of Gascon trade will topple, devoured from the inside.
My stars! I'll be doubling my sacrifice to Carvajal tonight.
Blaze smiled slightly in case the man was joking.
The palace servant cleared his throat. Blaze stepped onto the lift, headed to the ground floor, called for his carriage, and headed back to his manor.
Taya was out. He tried to stay up until she returned, but found himself awakened by the click of the door. He wriggled from his stuffed chair and intercepted her in the hallway.
The Duke turned me down, he said.
She closed and latched the door.
Maybe you should have worn a sluttier dress.
He didn't try to bargain, didn't even try to stall me. I think he's out of the picture.
Have you turned up any leads on the attackers?
Nothing yet. It takes time for information to percolate through a city, like a bead of blood dropped in a glass of water.
That's an unnecessarily gruesome image, Blaze said. If the Duke's done, I'll write Caraday to schedule a meeting.
Keep hunting for whoever hired the attackers, but it's time to move forward.
Agreed, Taya said. The bubble market for Bossen is about to burst.
How can you tell?
I'm from Galador. We're born with a nose for these things.
Blaze rolled his eyes, but said nothing. He intended to spend the next couple days circulating in the salons bordering the Street of Kings, relate the bandit story a few times, ask other merchants about their experience on the roads, perhaps make some noise about organizing petitions and proposals. If he were feeling really ambitious, he might discreetly hire some bandits of his own to start harassing the woods. However, the issue of the roads presented him with a conundrum. Rather than being a waste of money and effort, spurring the king to clean up the roads might lead to increased commerce, and thus taxes, and thus Gascon power, the exact opposite of Blaze's goals. It felt like he ran into the situation a lot. He thought he was pretty good at improvising short-term tactics, escapes, robberies, gambits of all types. But this skill rarely translated into a successful long-term strategy. That pissed him off, not least because it didn't make any sense. Say the goal was to cross the road. That crossing would involve a discrete number of individual steps. If you improvised each step as it came, sooner or later you found yourself on the other side of the road. That was how it should work. In practice, if you kept both eyes on what your feet were doing and gave no care to what was coming down the road, you were liable to end up trampled halfway across it. Even so, it would be fun to hire a gang of threatening but ultimately non-violent highwaymen and wreak havoc on the Gascon interior. He thought he would give it a shot. He never got the chance. As he ate the next morning's breakfast, a knock sounded at the door. A man wearing a red doublet and a sword stood on the other side. On seeing Blaze, he stiffened his back.
"Lord Pendulous."
"That would be me," Blaze said.
"The king wishes your presence."
"He does," Blaze said. Behind the messenger, a carriage waited in the street.
"What, now?"
The man inclined his head.
"That is his desire."
"I haven't even had my tea."
"Tea will be provided in your conveyance."
"Look," Blaze said, mustering his best aristocratic hauteur. "I understand he's regent of all Gask. His time is worth more than the Pearl of Alldresser, ground up and served atop the meat of the tireless Pegasus. But I also know our great monarch is magnanimous, generous, and understanding. Surely he is kind enough to grant me 10 minutes to prepare myself to be worthy of his presence." The king's man took a small step back, regarded Blaze, and inclined his head again.
"Agreed. Take the time you deem necessary."
Blaze attempted to wrest the exasperation from his face.
"Thank you, good sir."
He closed the door, walked away from the entry, then sprinted upstairs. Taya sat in the library, bent over a desk overflowing with correspondence. "Guess who's just been summoned to the king," he said. She glanced up.
"Was it me? I've always wanted to meet a man of such high honor."
"His man's waiting outside. I should probably get dressed, shouldn't I?"
"What's the bastard want?"
"I don't know." Blaze ticked his nails against the doorframe. "Maybe I went overboard besmirching his roads." Taya straightened her papers.
"Are you nervous?"
"I've been dreaming about killing him for years.
Why would I be nervous?" "Better hurry. Your most bitter enemy awaits you."
He grinned and jogged to his room. He'd established the character of Pendulous as a man who dressed cleanly but not fussily. But this was the king. He changed into a fresh doublet and swapped his boots for ones he only wore to parties and meetings of the highest order. He gave thought to trimming his beard, but there wasn't time. Anyway, a summons like this, with no advance notice, was highly unusual. Mardigan would know Pendulous wouldn't have time to kid himself out with the proper respect. Hell, the king would probably be pissed off to see Blaze had wasted so much time smoothing every last hair and thread in place. In the street, the king's man showed him to his carriage, a sleek vessel of buffed red lacquer. The horses clopped confidently down the streets, scattering pedestrians like mackerel before a shark. The servant sat across from Blaze. Despite the rattling of the vehicle, he retrieved a tea tray from beneath the seat and poured Blaze a steaming mug without spilling a drop.
"Tea while you travel," Blaze said, halfway to himself. He wanted to inquire what this summons was about, but knew better than to ask,
and so he filled the time with idle chatter instead.
"I need this in my carriage. Or what about a tea delivery service?
Do you think people would go for that?"
"I couldn't say, my lord," the king's man said.
"Con, it's pretty easy to make tea for yourself. Pro, who wants to make their own damn tea?"
Blaze stared at the dark liquid in his cup. In order to help sustain the illusion that he was a wealthy merchant, he'd gotten in the habit of musing about hypothetical business ventures, and had found, to his great surprise, that he enjoyed it.
Commerce was like a philosopher's stone that turned ideas into gold.
It was fascinating.
On reflection, a tea delivery service was probably not a viable enterprise. If someone were to run out to order tea delivered, they may as well just pick it up. Perhaps it would be useful at large meetings and the like, but anyone scheduling such an event would be wealthy enough to have servants to take care of their tea for them. The concept was intriguing, but the logistics rendered it a non-starter.
However, if people had the means to order tea without leaving their homes, if they all had loons, say, his brain might be sitting on a fortune.
The cart slowed, climbing an arched bridge over a minor tributary of the river that split the capital. Now that he thought about it, loons were easily among the most valuable items in the world. Yet, so far as he knew, they were completely uncommercialized. The only people who owned them were Norrin tribes and Dante's people. If Blaze could get his hands on a source,
then they'd soon wind up appropriated by King Modigan, who would use them to solidify the very empire Blaze was attempting to crumble.
Still, fun to think about. Really, many parts of business were fun. He got to travel, see strange places, plot and scheme and brainstorm. If he had his life to do over, he'd spend part of it as a merchant. He'd be damn good at it, too. Become disgustingly rich while seeing the world and having a blast. Sounded pretty good, especially if he got to challenge people to duels when they tried to gouge him. But he didn't have that option. His life was committed to a much different course.
The carriage swung onto the swarming street of kings. Blaze swilled his tea, which had gone lukewarm.
He didn't bother to glance at the lake as they crossed the causeway to the palace. The wheels crunched to a stop in the red gravel. A servant materialized to open Blaze's door. He forgot to thank the man. He tilted back his head and pretended to appreciate the layered palace while he adjusted his attitude. No time for surliness. Not in front of the king.
The man who'd summoned him waited until Blaze was ready, then guided him up the steps. Two armed guards fell in beside them, accompanying them to the lift. The bell jangled three times. The platform clunked and raised.
"Has this thing ever collapsed?" Blaze said.
The servant glanced at him sidelong.
"I can assure you it's safe."
"If it's the same as the king's, I'm sure it is. I'm just curious. Would be a heck of a ride down, eh?"
The man nodded indulgently. Blaze made no further efforts to engage him. After a slow ascent, the platform rocked to a stop at the top floor. More guards waited on the landing, inspecting the platform's occupants. The servant gestured the way forward and Blaze stepped off.
Ceilings hung 20 feet above them. Patterns of bright red stone zagged through the white marble walls. Silver artifacts rested on pedestals around the walls of the vast circular foyer. The servant's shoes whispered over lush carpets. He brought Blaze to a cherrywood door and led him through a quick series of wood-paneled passages. Typically, when the weather was fine, as it was this morning, the nobles preferred to sit around their terraces. But the room Blaze was deposited in was windowless and small. The walls featured paintings and end tables, but the middle of the room